Welcome to the Compassionate Leaders Circle podcast. For thousands of years, the sages have known that compassion is a powerful force for good. In the last two decades, compassion scholars caught up with these sages, proving that there is an ROI to building loving communities and businesses. This podcast features leaders who can teach us about the power of compassion. It is my honor to have Kevin Oakes with me today. He is the co-founder and CEO at the Institute for Corporate Productivity, but he also has a cool nickname that is I4CP for that organization. I had the privilege of just completing his amazing book called Culture Renovation, and building healthy cultures is a passion of mine. I think I first got introduced to culture by being an IBM kid. So my dad worked for IBM. And so IBM was a real big part of my upbringing. Kevin, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Laurel. I appreciate you having me here.
So my first question is, how do you define culture?
You know, it's funny, in the book itself, I really stayed away from defining it. It kind of bugged me, honestly, that a lot of books, they start out by just having to define culture. I think a lot of people know it. One definition that my co-founder uses is culture is what's felt by people because of what's done or condoned, rewarded, encouraged, or even penalized inside of the organization. He and I both like another definition that Herb Kelleher of Southwest Airlines had. Culture is what people do when no one is looking, right? So it's really just the norms inside the organization, the way the, you know, you think and act and interact inside the organization.
I love that. I was told, I think a lot about it is culture is the view from the fly on the wall.
That's a good one too. I like that. I'll attribute that to Laurel Donaldham.
I'm sure I learned it from someone else, but I don't remember who. But that's what I think about. And I used to just think about it from internal stakeholders, and now I really think about it as internal and external.
Sure.
I'm really excited about the type of work your organization does, and that your book is data driven. Can you just tell us a little bit about the research you do and how you gather all this amazing data?
Yeah, and just a little bit of background on the company. So we are a research organization. Today we do more HR research than just about anybody on the planet. It's always with a business lens, Laurel, of how are high-performing organizations treating their people, or how, you know, what are they doing with their people programs that's different than low-performing organizations? And we define performance as companies that have better revenue growth, profitability, market share, so real financial measures. We almost always find a difference between those, the high and lows. And while we come up with a lot of best practices of high performing organizations, what we really hang our hat on are next practices. We define those as practices where we can see a real strong correlation to that bottom line business impact, but not a lot of companies have yet put that practice into place, usually less than 20% or so. And so that any research study that we come out with will highlight a few next practices that we think companies should be aware of. And you know, keeping in mind for the future, we try to look around the corner for them. This particular topic of culture was a real passion of mine. And I was very intrigued by a statistic that we had come up with in our research that of all organizations that try to change their culture, only 15% actually succeed. So 1.5% is a pretty small percentage. And I was intrigued by what are those organizations doing differently that the other 85% clearly are not. And so that's how we really dove into the research that went behind the book, is trying to uncover a blueprint or a roadmap that we could convey to others on how to change culture. I really, you know, I think in the research and in the book, we kind of took the viewpoint of the CEO or the head of HR who was trying to do this. I think inherently they know culture is important, but as I looked at a lot of other books and other literature that existed on culture, very little of it told you how to change it. It just talked about the importance of culture and was very theoretical about culture, but there really was no guideline for how to change it. And that's really what we set out to do with the research.
And where do you get your data set? Who is participating in this research?
So we have a database of 30 to 40,000 organizations worldwide that we reach out to for all of the research that we do. We generally are working with the heads of HR and organizations and HR leadership teams and HR teams overall, but it's a pretty broad set of people that we reach out to in those 30 to 40,000 companies. A lot of business leaders, people who in different functions in those organizations.
And is it small companies, large companies, or is it mostly large?
It's all over the map. We even bifurcate the data by large, medium, and small companies for every study that we do. We typically will report out data on companies that have 10,000 or more employees, but we'll report on companies that have between 1 and 10,000 and then under 1,000 employees, just to see what kind of differences there are in those size companies.
Fantastic. I mean, as I read your book, there's a lot of great stories about, you know, the CEO of Microsoft and all different types of brands that we might recognize. But I was wondering if these lessons apply to startups and small companies as well. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I get that question all the time, and I absolutely think they do. We actually run a group of unicorn companies. So these are startups that have a valuation of $1 billion or more. And I love working with that class of organization because they're growing very fast. HR was often an afterthought in those companies. It wasn't the first department that they really fleshed out. But as they grow rapidly, they realize that some of these issues that we talk about in the book, like having a healthy culture, are going to be critical to their financial long-term success. And I think a lot of the lessons that we found from, you know, the very big, well-known companies are ones that any organization can apply. And so in the research and in the book itself, you'll see there are 18 action steps that organizations can take in order to change culture. And when we first started out with the research study, we were using the term culture transformation, which is the more common term. But as we got into it, I recognized that many of the case studies that we were highlighting and the companies we were talking to, they didn't transform themselves. You know, they didn't completely change who they were. Instead, what they did was very carefully renovate what made them great to begin with, what was unique about their organization, and kind of like an old house. They were improving the value for the future by that renovation. And so renovation just became a better descriptor and a more accessible term, I think, for what we were trying to uncover. And so we divvied up those 18 action steps into three phases using that renovation theme of plan, build, and maintain. And I think for small companies or large companies, those three phases are critical if you're trying to make inroads and changes to your culture. Now, I've had some startups say, okay, that's great, but I'm trying to create a culture from start. Maybe that'll be the next book, Laurel. But I think a lot of the learnings that are in this book, you can also use to create a culture from start.
Yeah, I mean, Kevin is not paying me, but I think this book is fantastic. And I believe it applies to even a solopreneur creating a brand or creating a company. So, this is what I'm passionate about, is creating healthy leaders and healthy cultures and healthy people. And it's nothing in here is scary. It's all very common sense. It's just not always common practice. So I'm going to zone in on something that I've struggled with throughout my HR career and leadership development career, is performance management.
Yeah.
And for those of you that are listening, don't turn off the podcast now, but I think it's really important, and I think that very few people do it well. So could you just sort of help people who, you know, maybe are growing a small company think about this in a positive and productive way? Could you give us a little starter kit on performance management?
Yeah, we've done a lot of work on this over the years, and there's no one formula that's right for every company is the first thing I want to say. I think each organization has to adopt what fits best for their industry, for their, you know, their marketplace, the type of company they are, et cetera. But it is clear that the more you can train managers to have constructive performance conversations with their reports, the better your organization will be. And the more frequent they can have those conversations, the better your organization will be. There's obviously been a large movement away from the annual performance review, which I think is healthy, because you shouldn't be talking about performance just once a year. You should be talking about it more frequently. But also, there's been a movement away from rating systems. And some of that's been healthy and some of it hasn't been. In the book, I highlight some situations where companies had forced ranking or forced distribution systems, and I'm not a fan of those. This is where a manager is asked to rank their employees top to bottom. That creates oftentimes an environment where, if you and I are coworkers, Laurel, my main motivation is to beat you, and your main motivation is to beat me, as opposed to us teaming together to, you know, be better against the competition.
It also assumes that talent is spread evenly throughout the organization, which doesn't really happen, right? There could be some teams that are super performers and some teams that are underperforming. So yeah, that doesn't feel quite right.
Yeah, I think that's right. And, you know, I think the flip side, what we're finding is that companies that have completely gone away from ratings have gotten a little lackadaisical in how they're, you know, handling performance management. So, you know, my encouragement is for those organizations to make sure managers are well-trained on how to have productive performance conversations.
What do you think of job descriptions? Are they obsolete now?
They often get outdated very quickly, almost the day somebody arrives on the job. You know, look, I'm well-written job descriptions, I think, can be very helpful to the applicant to better understand, you know, what is expected of them and what they're getting themselves into. I'm a big fan of realistic job previews, because I think what oftentimes happens is somebody comes into a job and they thought it was one thing, turns out to be another. Those are the people that generally, you know, flame out in 6 months or a year because it wasn't what they expected. You might as well have them understand exactly what it is, or as best as you can, right up front, so that they can select out even before they start if it's not going to be the right role for them. So job descriptions, I think, are undergoing a little bit of a change right now. You know, I think the less complicated, the better is probably the right thing to do in job descriptions, but also because things change so quickly these days, make that well known. You make it well known that, you know, there are elements of the job that may shift over time, and, you know, we'll discuss those.
Yeah. So over 3 years ago, I named my company Compassionate Leader Circle. So I have a lot of pressure on myself to be more of a compassionate leader. Do you feel a lot of pressure to be productive as a leader in your organization?
Well, yeah, we have it in our name. So we certainly that's an important aspect, I think, of what we focus on. But empathy and compassion are absolutely critical to production and to productivity. We've seen, you know, a good recognition since the start of the pandemic of how important it is for leaders to have empathy for the workforce. For the workforce in general, for their direct reports. We've opened up our eyes, I think, to a fuller picture of the people that work in organizations. We're not just seeing the business persona anymore. Zoom and in remote work and flexible work have shown us sides of the employees that we may not have known before. A lot of employees are caregivers that we didn't realize, they had family situations that we didn't understand. And so I think all of that helps us become a little bit more empathetic to, to the workforce. But certainly in today's market where, talent is, has been leaving and switching jobs and engaging that talent, I'm so tired of the stupid phrase quiet quitting, but, engaging that talent and making sure that they are engaged. A lot of it boils down to having that empathy for the workforce and that compassion.
We definitely are in a business of a lot of jargon and hanging on to too much jargon's too long, I think. And yeah. One of the things I like about your book is it feels very evergreen, like you wrote it during COVID, right?
I did, yep.
And I feel like good business practices, yes, the world is changing quicker. We have more technology. We're more global. But I think good culture and good management practices, a lot of them are just evergreen and very down to earth. And they're very humane. It comes down to people, right?
Right.
So I'm curious about your business model. How does your organization, you do all this amazing research and you're not a university. So how does your organization make money?
Well, it's a subscription model. So companies subscribe to get access to that research, but they also get access to a closed peer network. We have tens of thousands of HR executives in this network. And I say it's closed because there's no vendors or consultants in the network. It's just practitioners. And so it's psychologically safe for people in that network to share strategies, to ask real questions, to share tools. Without fear that they're going to get sold to by somebody, like you might on LinkedIn, for instance.
Yeah. Conferences, right?
And we do that same, we take that same philosophy at conferences that we run. We don't have any vendors there. We don't have any trade shows. So it becomes a safe environment to just explore the issues and explore answers to initiatives that organizations are undertaking, as opposed to getting tapped on the shoulder by vendor after vendor.
Now, I used to be an internal HR person, so I you weren't around when I was that, but that sounds really smart and really good. I'm just curious about you and your background. How did you end up in this business? How did you grow up? I noticed you did dedicate the book to your dad. I'm always curious about things like that.
I did. My dad is very important to me and had a big part in my career. I started my career out of college at Fidelity Investments, and then I worked for an insurance company. But one day kind of woke up and said, I don't think I want to work for an insurance company long term, and began exploring different entrepreneurial opportunities at the same time that my dad was also had just left a CEO role. He was CEO of a large insurance company. And so we began exploring some things together, and we started our initial company together, which was an e-learning company way in the early days of e-learning, even before the web. And we quickly built a company that was producing e-learning for corporate training on CD-ROM, and then we migrated to the web. One of our partners was the first company that Paul Allen had founded after Microsoft. And Paul had a vision of IPOing that organization, but approached me and said, I want to IPO this, but we're not big enough. What if we join forces? And so that's exactly what we did. We took the company public. The company was called Click to Learn at the time. I was CEO of the organization, and we just began growing it as e-learning started exploding. Eventually, I merged it with another public company along the way to form a new company called Sum Total Systems. So that was all prior to me starting the current organization. And I stayed on, even after I started this organization, I stayed on the board there and spent quite a few years with the company. But I've always been passionate about people issues. I started in the L&D space, as I broadened my horizons in human capital and in HR, I could see that it was slowly becoming more and more strategic in organizations. And today, while I still think we've got a ways to go, I'm really heartened by so many organizations that look at the HR organization as critically important, as strategic. I can always tell when I walk into a company, if that head of HR is in the inner circle of, you know, the top three or four people with the CEO, that's going to be a healthy company. And it's typically a company that's performing quite well. So it's fun to see HR, you know, really blossom, I think, lately, and just become so critical to the success of so many organizations.
Yes, I think it's time that the chief people officers and HR people have a seat at the table. So if you are one of those, you can take that quote from Kevin and bring it over to your CEO. I do think we're in a really exciting time. And I think part of it is, you know, because unfortunately, because of the pandemic and a lot of shifts in work style and in the labor force, I think employees have more power than they used to have. What do you think about that?
Absolutely. It's I joke all the time, the war for talent is over and the talent won.
That's a good one.
You know, I think it's a, you know, it's a market for employees to really think about what do you want to do, what kind of organization you want to be in. Now, you know, this, it's changing a little bit right now, you know, as we go into more uncertain economic times, but I think it's still a very healthy market for talent, particularly top talent. And I think that's what worries a lot of CEOs and worries a lot of organizations. Are we doing enough to retain our top talent, to retain our high potential talent? You'll see a lot more about that going forward, for sure. But, you know, I think the smart organizations are using empathy to help not only retain, but also attract talent. They think a lot about their employer brand, and that's something we write a lot about. You know, how are you projecting yourselves as a place to work externally? We often talk about that in the context of flexible and hybrid, you know, or remote work these days. You know, there are some companies that have been fairly draconian about saying, okay, everybody's got to be in the office at least 40 hours a week, 5 days a week. And then there are other companies that have been much more flexible. I would say most companies have been much more flexible. But everybody's still kind of feeling their way through this. And I think whatever, wherever you land, it really does impact your long-term employer brand. So you've got to think carefully about it.
Yeah, I think employer brand and living up to the employer brand is going to be a good conversation going forward. And I'm very curious because I do a lot of personal career development work as well as company career development work. I'm curious about how mental health and working from home is going to correlate, because I think I work with a lot of people who are completely fine working from home and they're not doing their laundry during their team meetings and they have that discipline. And I think there's a lot of people that should never work from home because it's just not really good. They don't have the right discipline and they don't have the right personality to be alone.
And sometimes they don't have the right situation. I quoted the CEO of MasterCard in the book talking about that. You know, it's easy to say working from home is good when you've got, you know, a 5,000 square foot house with air conditioning and great Wi-Fi. But he talked a lot about a lot of his employees. You know, they might be, you know, in a situation where they've got the mother-in-law and kids in a, you know, one or two bedroom apartment and dogs and, you know, not great Wi-Fi. And so the office is often the respite, you know, so it just really depends on the situation. And that's where I think flexibility is so critical. You know, as managers, we have to get comfortable with providing flexibility.
Yeah, I work with one company that I think has figured this out because they are giving everyone a choice. So you can work from home, you can work in the office, or you could do hybrid. And I was in the office a few months ago and it was all like working moms, you know, working together, having, you know, from 8 o'clock to 3 in the office and then picking up their kids. So I think it's going to be exciting to see what works and what doesn't work.
Yeah, so companies are getting a little bit more thoughtful about what they want the in-office experience to be like. It's really not helpful to anybody if you're requiring people to come in the office and then they just sit on Zoom calls all day in the office, right? That's and so I think, companies are recognizing that.
So what are you, based on all your research and your knowledge and your experience, what are you looking forward to? What are you predicting as next practices?
There's a number of areas that we look at. You touched on well-being, and I wanted to comment on that. We have done a lot of work on various aspects of well-being. Certainly, there's been a lot of attention to physical well-being. We just did a study on financial well-being, which more and more companies are paying attention to, is trying to, make sure that the workforce feels financially taken care of and that they have some help, with financial decisions. But that mental and emotional aspect of well-being is where the majority of investment has been made. And I think it is important going forward. It wasn't that long ago that as a manager, it was sort of taboo to talk to your employees about their, their mental state, right? You typically stayed away from that conversation. And today, a lot of organizations are helping managers start those conversations, address that with the workforce, training them how to, how to have the conversation. And I think that's healthy. And I think more and more individuals are recognizing that that's the kind of place they want to be, where you can have those open conversations with the workforce. But going forward, I still feel like we've got a long ways to go to figure out this flexible or hybrid environment. We're innovating there on a regular basis, both in our processes and in the technology that helps it. So I think there's going to be a lot more that happens there. We have a new culture survey that's out in the field right now, where we're exploring that, and we're also just exploring how did culture change during the pandemic. What's different today than before the pandemic, and then what are the elements of a healthy versus a toxic culture? And I think some companies get derailed because they let toxic subcultures fester too much, and then it affects the broader culture. So that's fascinating. But every week, Laurel, I'm just delighted. We've got a great research team, and they just come up with different research that's just so fun to dive into, and just so forward-looking. It's always a new topic and always very interesting information.
Well, at Compassionate Leader Circle, when we talk to people who are running companies, I like to touch on three things, and I see that Brené Brown endorsed your book, so you'll appreciate this. So I think about compassionate cultures is requiring three things: self-compassion, vulnerability, and compassion for others. And so I'm curious, from a personal standpoint, how do you take care of yourself and how do you create self-compassion?
I probably don't do a good enough job at that overall, but I try to be cognizant of how much I'm working and the hours you put in, and I think you just got to be smart. Treat yourself like you want your employees to treat themselves, and as a leader, certainly it's putting your oxygen mask on first kind of thing. You want to make sure that you're setting the right tone and setting the right example. I don't always do that. I try to be very transparent with my team that I don't always do that. Transparency is one of our values in our company, and so we just try to be very clear with each other, where we need improvement and what we need to do going forward. And that's probably an area I need to improve going forward personally.
Most of the compassionate leaders I talk to need to improve that. That's why, including myself, so that's why I asked the question. And talk to me about transparency and vulnerability and creating a safe space in your culture.
One of the most transparent things we do is I run the company on an open book policy. So every single month, we go over all the financials of the organization. They all know how we're doing versus our plan, how we're doing versus last year, what's our EBITDA, and we've had to teach people, you know, even what that means. You know, what's our cash position? So we try to be extremely transparent just about what's happening in the organization, so that there's no, you know, rumors, or, you know, everybody's on the same page from that perspective. But we hold ourselves accountable for transparency. If we feel like, you know, there's areas of the company or people in the company that aren't being transparent, we will call them out and we'll talk about that. Yeah, I think Brené on a podcast I did with her had a really good point around transparency. She kind of eliminated the meeting after the meeting, you know, and that happens in a lot of organizations. You know, you have a meeting, you make decisions, then people meet after the meeting and they're against the decision you just made, but they didn't voice it in the meeting. They try to make something like that taboo in the organization. And I think that's a healthy thing. You know, speak up if you have concerns. That, you know, the whole concept of psychologically safe workplaces helps those conversations happen. And I think overall cuts time, cuts bureaucracy, and makes you a more agile organization in general.
I like that. Get rid of the meeting after the meeting. Speak up. And lastly, I know that you and your organization do a lot of give back. So can you tell me about how you are compassionate to the not-for-profits you're involved with?
Yeah, the biggest one that we support and I support overall is Best Buddies, which has been around for quite some time. Best Buddies serves individuals with intellectual and developmental disabilities. It was my VP of sales who introduced Best Buddies to our organization roughly 10 years ago. She has a son with Down syndrome, and she's been involved with the organization for some time. So there's a lot of ways we've supported Best Buddies. We've done some research together around the employability of people with IDD, and we're big supporters of the jobs program. The unemployment rate for people with IDD is astronomically high, like 85-90%. So we're very proud when we help organizations hire individuals through Best Buddies job program. And we're continuing to make inroads there. We also, in the state of Washington, there was not a local Best Buddies chapter. So we got one launched about 4 years ago. I sit on the board there, and we've made some great strides just in the state. So that's a big one for us. And we put a lot of time and effort and visibility into Best Buddies.
And you're helping diversify a workforce, which needs to be diversified in all sorts of ways, right?
The hidden talent pool. In fact, we've done broader studies on just individuals with disabilities, and that is a hidden talent pool for a lot of organizations. And you know, it's an area that I think some companies could do more with.
I've been talking to a lot of people about just what we call boomerang employees, hiring people that know your culture and having them come back. There's lots of great nuggets of wisdom in your book. I'm going to plug it again. It's called Culture Renovation. Tell us how we buy your book and how we learn more about your organization.
Yeah, the book's on all the normal channels. There is a website for the book called culturerenovation.com, and you can find some things that aren't in the book on that website. And sign up for a newsletter that I write each month. In fact, it's due. I'm being nagged to make sure I get it done this month. And what we do in that newsletter and on that site are just highlight some different case studies, new research. We will highlight that. This is an ongoing conversation, and that's the way I end the book. You don't plant a flag in the ground and declare victory when it comes to culture. It's something that you're constantly working at. And that's why we wanted to create that website, because it is a constant process. And we expect there's, you know, more and more stories and innovations that'll happen around culture. So you asked about the company itself. You'll find info and links to our company from that website, but you can also go out to i4cp.com and learn more directly about the organization as well.
Well, thank you so much for spending time today. I really enjoyed our conversation, and I hope you have a great afternoon.
You as well, Laurel. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for listening to the Compassionate Leaders podcast. You can learn more about us at CompassionateLeadersCircle.com. Please join us each week as we shine a light on compassionate leaders making a positive impact on their communities and the world.